From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. So let's say you're a baker in Missouri and a couple calls and wants to hire you to make a cake for their wedding. But when they come into your shop, it turns out they're a same-sex couple and you don't agree with gay marriage. Missouri is one of several states where the fight over gay marriage hasn't died down. Lawmakers there are proposing a constitutional amendment to protect people who want to deny services to gay couples. Legislation like this is springing up all over the country in response to last year's Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage. Supporters, including some Republican presidential candidates, say it allows people to stay true to their morals. Critics say it's a way to legalize discrimination. These fights over what some see as religious freedom are nothing new. They've been happening in the courts, in businesses, in schools, and even in daycares. In most states, all daycares are licensed and have to meet basic standards of safety and care for kids. But in 16 states, church-run daycares face looser rules. And in Alabama, there are virtually no rules for religious daycares. The state doesn't even have the authority to investigate problems, let alone close them. Alabama kids have been beaten, locked in closets, and wandered off alone because they were so poorly supervised, and the daycares have stayed open. Reporter Amy Julia Harris and producer Delaney Hall went to Alabama to follow the trail of a woman who's opened almost a dozen problematic daycares by using the religious exemption.
This is my daughter, Carly. She's talkative, and it's past her bedtime, so she's being funny.
Sarah Lee Morales lives in a small and tidy trailer with her soon-to-be husband and her three kids in Locksley, Alabama. It's a tight-knit town down near the Gulf Coast.
A few years ago, Sarah got a job with a daycare in Locksley called A Step Ahead. It was run by a woman named Deborah Stokes. She told Sarah it was a Christian daycare, affiliated with Alpha and Omega Ministries.
I just assume when you say Christian-based, that's going to be, you know, a little bit of a Bible study thrown in there, and we're going to, you know, do our morning prayer, our meal prayer, the types of things which you actually do at, like, Bible school or a Christian school.
It turned out that Deborah was the founder of Alpha and Omega. As far as anyone knew, the ministry didn't have a congregation or any regular church services. On the paperwork Deborah filed with the state, she's identified as the pastor, but it's unclear if she was ever ordained. And within a few days of starting at the daycare, Sarah noticed that Deborah wasn't acting like much of a Christian.
She would scream at the kids for very, very stupid little bitty things.
For peeing in their pants, for example, or for making too much noise. Sarah watched kids sit for hours in front of the TV. She saw kids left unsupervised because there wasn't enough staff. Even if Deborah said she was running a Christian operation, Sarah didn't believe it.
You can't just go by what people say. You have to go by their actions. You know, you can go up to somebody and, you know, quote words from the Bible, but hey, Satan knows the Bible too. He can quote it for you word for word. Satan can.
Then one day, soon after Sarah started, she went into work and found Deborah dismantling the place.
They were all stacking up the chairs and stuff that the kids would sit in. And I looked at her and she was like, well, we're moving down the road to the warehouse.
At this point, Sarah was already fed up with Deborah. She says she hadn't been paid in over a month, so she quit.
As it turns out, this hurried move was classic Deborah Stokes. Open up a daycare, run it for a few months, rack up complaints from parents and employees, and then close up and move on. She'd been doing this for 8 years.
Before opening A Step Ahead in Locksley, Deborah operated at least 6 daycares in the Mobile area, about an hour north. Several of those were temporarily shut down by county officials for health and safety violations. Back in 2002, Deborah was even arrested and later convicted of child endangerment. She was banned from operating a daycare for 2 years.
Hi, may I please speak to Deborah Stokes?
This is she.
Hi, Deborah. My name is Amy Harris. And
our first day in Alabama, we gave Deborah a call. We asked her about all the run-ins she had had with the county health inspector in Mobile, who'd followed up on more than 20 complaints against her. They ranged from hitting kids with wooden rulers to leaving infants in tiny rooms by themselves. Deborah said the health inspector had a vendetta against her.
She said, look, let me tell you something. I will make up, I will lie, I will do whatever I have to do to keep you shut down because I hate it. I'm an atheist. I hate churches. I hate Christians. And you'll never open.
Well, Deborah says a lot of people are out to get her, including Sarah Morales, her former worker. She went on like this for about an hour. Finally, we asked if we could come by and see her later in the week, and she agreed.
Yeah, you've given me a lot. Thank you so much for talking to me. And I'll see you on Thursday at 6, and we can just continue the conversation and just get a tour of your daycare.
All right.
Okay, sounds good. All right, thanks so much, Debbie. Bye.
In the meantime, we continued to follow Deborah's trail across Lower Alabama.
After leaving her daycare in Locksley and then spending several months at a warehouse down the street, Deborah ended up in the nearby town of Foley. She opened up a daycare on East Myrtle Street and racked up 16 complaints from workers and parents. She failed to pay rent again and then moved on to a place called Kidspace in a small strip mall.
I think it's a little bit further down.
Right between a pawn shop and a porn store.
Yeah, so it says adult gifts in big red letters on a yellow sign, lingerie, body jewelry, and novelties.
In Alabama, it's illegal for a porn shop to open next to a daycare. But as it turns out, it's not illegal for a daycare to open next to a porn shop. And that's exactly what Deborah did. Then she set about hiring staff.
She didn't ask my full name. She didn't ask for an ID.
This is Kimberly Nicole Hinman, a former employee at Kidspace. She was hired by the director of Deborah's daycare.
She didn't ask if I had felonies or if I'd ever been in trouble. She didn't ask if I liked children. She said, can you start working right now? And I was like, yeah, okay.
Kimberly Nicole told us she was drawn to working at the daycare, partly because she grew up going to Christian schools.
What was your Christian education like?
I always found that, you know, it was warm and welcoming and, you know, you're kind to everyone. I guess it's easy to take something like that and turn it into something ugly like Debbie did.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there was nothing kind or warm or welcoming about her whatsoever. She was not the kind of person I would trust alone with a glow stick, let alone a child, you know.
Kimberly Nicole said the scene at Kidspace was often chaotic and that Deborah could get rough with the kids.
I saw her put a 5-year-old boy in that high chair and leave him there for 3 hours with him screaming and rocking. And she went over there and shook the floss water at him and told him that he was fixing to get it.
Finally, after 4 or 5 months, Kimberly Nicole just quit in the middle of the day. And then she enlisted the help of a friend to rally against Deborah. By this time, Deborah had moved her operations to the neighboring town of Spanish Fort. A handful of people protested on the sidewalk outside.
She hits the kids with floss water, puts tape over little kids' mouths, puts them in the high chair and leaves them for hours.
The protesters held signs, and cars honked in support as they drove by.
She forced him to lay down, like literally forced him to lay down, and he cried.
Despite the protests, nothing really happened. Deborah just kept going.
By this point, parents and angry staffers had been complaining about Deborah for more than 10 years. But state regulators' hands were tied. In Alabama, church daycare centers can apply for a religious exemption.
That means they don't have to be regularly inspected, they aren't required to supervise children, and they don't have to follow any guidelines about how they discipline kids. It's really just up to police to investigate if there are problems.
But the police say they can't do much either. Lieutenant David White, a police officer in Foley, is shuffling through a big stack of police reports.
This is a report from a parent where a laptop was basically taken by one of the employees, one of the kids' laptop.
He says his department responded to over 20 incidents at Deborah's 2 daycares in Foley. Some parents complained that the daycare wasn't doing criminal background checks on employees. Another parent said Deborah had stolen her daughter's jacket in the middle of the winter. Most of the complaints were about fights between angry parents and defensive staff members, but some were fights between the staff members and Deborah Stokes.
It appears that this was a report concerning a former employee who came in and was being very boisterous and aggressive. And at one point, she stated, I will throw this pickle jar at you.
So she's come in with a pickle jar in hand to maybe threaten Debbie?
I don't know where she got the pickle jar from. I mean, there were some violent episodes there that could have turned bad and possibly injured a child. And that's what we were trying to do, is to keep these children safe.
The cops took reports and showed up at the daycare to break up fights. But unless the problems were actually against the law, they were powerless. Once the chaos died down, Deborah could continue as usual.
With the exemption, she could open up basically anywhere and be okay with it. You know, the law is unfortunate. It does not protect the kids. It allows for these type of daycares to open up without any restrictions, without any inspections.
And the frustrating thing for many city officials is that they can't intervene either. John Conier is the mayor of Foley. He served in the city government for a long time.
Served on the city council since 1980, so I qualify to be a good old boy. Been around here a long time.
When the Foley City Council heard Deborah would be opening another daycare in town, they voted to deny her a business license. But because of the religious exemption law, they couldn't.
We were not happy about issuing the license because of her previous background information we had about her, but we had no choice.
The battle over religious exemptions goes back to the 1970s. That's when Alabama passed its first child care licensing law. It required that all daycares meet basic standards, even the religious ones.
And ministers didn't like it. For a long time, they'd been running daycares out of their churches without any state interference. Robin Mears is the executive director of the Alabama Christian Education Association.
Because we don't believe the state should have the power to license a church. Now, I know they're going to tell you where we're licensing a daycare. The daycare, under legal authority, is a part of the church, just like any other ministry. A ladies' ministry, the Sunday school, anything else.
Robin joined a group of ministers who banded together to fight the licensing law. Finally, after years of lobbying, the state legislature passed the religious exemption in the early 80s. Robin says state regulations are overrated. They can't possibly fix every problem.
When you have humans involved, there will be errors in judgment, and there will be issues. Now, to think that all of a sudden you can license several hundred daycares in the state of Alabama and it's going to change the dynamic, it's not true. It won't happen. It won't change the dynamic.
Foco.
Hi there. We were here to speak with Sophia Bracey Harris.
Okay.
Church lobbyists may have won the battle over deregulating religious daycares, but some people are still fighting. Sophia Bracey Harris runs the Federation of Child Care Centers of Alabama.
We license everything in the state, you know, from our vets, from our salons, any and everything. And we exempt facilities when it comes to our children if they happen to say that they are religious. It undercuts the whole system for the health and safety of children.
Sophia says that most parents she works with aren't even aware that church-affiliated daycares don't have to be licensed. Sometimes they just close their eyes to the fact that things seem a little off. They don't have many options when it comes to child care, and religious daycares are often cheaper.
It's kind of like my sense is that there are a lot more children here than needs to be here. But, you know, I've got to be at work tomorrow. They have no other choice.
And what scares you most about what's going on in these religious unlicensed daycares?
For me, what scares me most is what we don't know.
But what we do know is troubling. We reviewed 180 complaints made against unlicensed religious daycares in two Alabama counties and found they have a ton of problems. Children were hit, slapped, and locked in closets. At one daycare in Jefferson County, parents said a teacher hit their son with a belt, leaving bruises.
At another church daycare, an infant was left in a room by himself, and he fell out of his swing and hit his head. He was rushed to the hospital when he started having seizures. All of these daycares remained open, despite repeated complaints from parents over the past 5 years.
Which brings us back to Deborah Stokes. You'll remember that earlier in the week she'd agreed to talk to us.
But when we tried to contact her again, we got a threatening email that made us think we might not be so welcome. This is a formal demand, she wrote to us. Do not drive, walk, jump, swim, or hop on this property. But we still had important questions and wanted to hear her side.
Oh, I see some kids through the door.
Since closing her daycare in Locksley and Kid Space in Foley, Deborah has moved to yet another town to open her latest operation, Little Nemo's by the Bay in Spanish Fort. So we went there.
Hi there. Hi, we're looking for Deborah Stokes.
She's not here.
She's not here?
No.
Do you know when she's going to be back?
We went to the gas station next door and tried to call her.
But it sounds busy.
Maybe she's making a call.
Maybe she's just calling the cops.
And in fact, Deborah was calling the cops on us. A few minutes later, three squad cars pulled up. An officer approached us.
Get their side of the story. What have y'all got going on?
Okay. We're journalists who are trying to talk to Debbie Stokes for a story we're doing.
Gotcha.
And I'm wondering, have you guys gotten a lot of police calls or complaints about this facility or daycare?
I'm not sure how much of that I can disclose to you, but it's not my first time meeting her, if that answers your question at all.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
The squad cars pulled away.
Since we left Alabama, we've requested all the available reports on Little Nemo's. Here's what we found. Building inspectors called Deborah's latest daycare, quote, dirty, and, quote, kind of nasty, but said that technically she, quote, meets the requirements by a minor stretch.
The fire marshal says she's technically okay, too. There aren't many police reports about Little Nemo's in the short time it's been up and running. But there was one from a former worker with a familiar-sounding complaint. She said Deborah wasn't paying her.
That was Amy Julia Harris and Delaney Hall. Just this past summer, something happened in Alabama that maybe, just maybe, started to shift public opinion on this issue.
More about a food poisoning outbreak at two daycare centers in Montgomery. You may recall the story. We now know what caused 86 children to get very sick.
30 of the children had to be hospitalized. The health department discovered bacterial contamination in the kitchens. It came out in reports that both were operated by a group called Sunnyside Daycare Centers, and both fell under the state's religious exemption. For the first time in as long as she could remember, Sophia Bracy Harris of the Federation of Child Care Centers of Alabama says people started questioning whether the exemption was a good thing.
I heard legislators for the first time saying, I think we need to look into this. And my thought was, I don't believe it.
Still, change will be hard in Alabama for one reason.
We live in a southern state in the Bible Belt where religion trumps damn near everything else.
That's Kimberly Nicole Hinman again, one of Deborah's former employees.
Let's stop worrying about church and start worrying about protecting our children, because this is getting ridiculous. I'm not against religion. I went to a Christian school. I believe in God, but you know what? I think God would understand.
Hundreds of children have been injured in religious daycares, and a few have even died. We're going to be investigating those stories in the coming weeks on our website, revealnews.org. Be sure to keep an eye on it. The issue of religious freedom can make for some strange bedfellows. In our next story, we look at a sex club that said it was a church to avoid zoning regulations. I kid you not. You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, podcast listeners. It's reporter Amy Julia Harris again. This time, I've got Reveal's Scott Pham with me. He designs interactive databases that illustrate information from our investigations. Scott, can you tell us about what you did for our reporting on religious daycares?
Yeah, we wanted to show how states have different laws regulating religious childcare facilities. So I built an interactive map of the U.S. that shows how states regulate or don't regulate religious daycares. You can check it out on the website, revealnews.org.
And the story you heard is only the beginning. I'm going to keep investigating abuse and negligence at childcare centers that operate with little to no oversight, thanks to religious exemption laws. You won't want to miss what's coming up. We'll be looking into how hundreds of children were seriously injured and a few who even died in religious daycares. We'll also expose scam artists who have claimed to be religious to avoid regulation. Sign up for our newsletter to get all my upcoming stories straight to your inbox. Just go to revealnews.org/newsletter to subscribe. That's revealnews.org/newsletter.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Etten. Religious freedom is one of the basic rights Americans count on. The First Amendment says,
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
But what happens if those rights of religion are being exercised inside a sex club? I'm pretty sure the founding fathers never considered that. But that's what one man in Nashville, Tennessee tried to do to keep his business open. We sent reporter Dan Weissman to check it out.
I meet Al Woods in the lobby of a hotel in Nashville where he's throwing a swingers party. He's a tall, skinny Vietnam vet, white hair, glasses, terrific posture. He moved here from Arkansas in 1980 with his second wife.
And I'd met her at a swingers party in Little Rock. Her and her date had just met at a Church of Christ singles meeting in Little Rock. And he said, well, you know, I got this little bar that we could go to. And she came to the bar and met me.
After they moved to Nashville, he took over a bar his sister had been running.
And she didn't make a go of it. And on the marquee outside, I put swingers welcome. And then that's when people started coming in.
By the late 1990s, his swingers club bought its own building in a crummy part of downtown, which eventually got less crummy. Restaurants and bars popped up. In 2014, a developer bought up most of the sex club's block for condos, including the carpet shop across the street, which created a problem for the club.
We rented their parking lot. They sold their building, so we had no parking. That's why we basically had to sell.
Club sold its building and cleared $1 million. Al found what he thought was a terrific new spot in a suburb called Madison, vacant medical center. Good price, big parking lot, lots of exam rooms for anyone who wanted a little privacy.
Hello, Larry.
Hello, Al.
Al's friend Larry Roberts has joined us. Larry is the club's lawyer and a longtime member of the Swingers Club. Larry remembers telling Al it was a terrible idea to locate in Madison, but Al insisted he had done his homework on the zoning.
And he said, no, said, this is a permissible use. Said, we have a printout. Sure enough, he had a printout, and it was a permissible use.
This was technically a club, and clubs were okay. Larry was unconvinced.
I said, you're going to create a firestorm. This close to Good Pasture.
Good Pasture. That's Good Pasture Christian School, a fancy private school. Johnny Cash's kids went there back in the day. And it operates right across the street from the site that Al was looking at for his sex club. Al bought the place anyway.
Good morning. Good to see you this morning. I'm doing well.
Ricky Perry is president of Good Pasture Christian School. We say hello outside his office, and he introduces me to a wagon full of one-year-olds.
They're out for a walk. They take their red buggies. This is Dan. How are y'all
hi,
doing
Dan.
This morning? Hi. Can y'all say hi to you this morning?
Say hi.
Hi.
He drives me around the campus, shows me how close the club's building is. It's just down the block from where parents will enter the auditorium where the school's first graders will be performing that evening. Ricky Perry asks me a question.
If you had your own children, would you want a business like that in close proximity to them?
He says he found out about the club's purchase from an anonymous note. It was from someone who claimed to be a member of the Swingers Club.
They, as an adult, were okay with that kind of lifestyle, but they were very concerned this was going to be near a school. I thought, wow, hadn't heard of that one, so I was surprised.
He started making calls. looking at the angles.
We looked at everything we thought we could do and decided that zoning was legally a way to thwart that. So that's what we tried.
The Nashville Metro Council, which has jurisdiction over Madison, started considering a new ordinance to change the zoning code and block the club. A few months later, the new zoning ordinance passed. Now, Al's permits to renovate his building were dead. And this is when Larry Roberts and Al Woods trotted out what I think it's fair to call their Hail Mary play. They said, oh, wait, did we say we're a sex club? Ooh, sorry, our bad. Actually, we're a religious institution. They submitted a new permit application. Here's how Al recalls it.
So we take the same plans in. All we do is rename the rooms on it and made a sanctuary instead of a dance area.
The two dungeons, one gets labeled the handbell room, the other the choir room. But the decor stays the same, painted black and red with wooden bars running to the ceiling. Larry Roberts says they even came up with a doctrine, a variation on the Ten Commandments.
Thou shalt not lie, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not have sex with any person other than thy spouse without the knowledge and consent of your spouse. And how all these religious do-gooders could object to this, I don't know.
Also, they said, no one would actually have sex on premises. And some swingers clubs do operate that way.
People might meet each other and go someplace else. But then, frankly, they do that at churches anyway.
They said, call us the United Fellowship Center. Al says they submitted the new paperwork shortly after the zoning ordinance passed.
That was on a Monday. They give us a permit on Wednesday.
Boom. Problem solved. The story hit the national media. Could a sex club really get away with calling itself a church? Legally, it is very hard to regulate religious institutions. Nelson Tebbe teaches constitutional law at Brooklyn Law School and has a PhD in religious studies. He says courts do tend to be very reluctant to weigh in on theological questions of any kind for two reasons. First, they don't teach theology in law school.
But second, and I think more deeply, courts believe it would be unfair, that it would be in some ways wrong for the government to decide that a particular theology does or doesn't require a particular action.
That's what religious pluralism is. If you say your religion requires you to go to sex parties, who am I to disagree? However, there is another big issue that courts do feel comfortable making judgments about. Is a professed religious belief sincerely held? And courts routinely make judgments about sincerity. Call it credibility.
When a witness comes before the court, courts feel that they're able to judge the credibility of a witness. It's something they do all the time.
On that basis, Nelson Tebbe told me if he were the lawyer for the Swingers Club, he probably would not have advised him to push the church idea too hard. I mean, it looks awfully convenient to suddenly become a religious institution when your back's against the wall. However, when I talked with Bill Herbert, Nashville's top zoning administrator, he said the what's a church issue is the million-dollar question.
At the end of the day, if they tell us that they are a church, we have to take their word for it until proven otherwise. It would have become an enforcement action if we had received information that what they were actually doing on the property once they opened was not a church.
That was April 2015. It took the club a while to start making renovations, updating bathrooms for people with disabilities, adding some new electrical wiring for sounds and lights. It took a few months to get the work done, but eventually inspectors started coming around and approving it. And then, September 25th, the very last inspector came from the fire department. Al says the fire marshal just said, no, no way. We're not doing this. I'm not inspecting this place. It's not a church. This place is obviously a swingers club.
And I've said, well, it's a building. Right now, your job is to approve it if it's safe or not safe. You know, he says, this is above my pay grade. I'm not getting involved in this.
I called the fire inspector, Daryl Rogan. He wouldn't talk on tape, and he wouldn't discuss what was said. But he did confirm that he went to the site September 25th, and he didn't do the inspection. The place was permitted as a church, he told me, and in his view, this place wasn't a church. Deciding whether the building was a church or not a church was up to the zoning director, Bill Herbert, who had already approved the plans. But Al Woods and Larry Roberts didn't push to get the inspection and the fellowship center opened as planned. Instead, what they did was to advertise their fully renovated building for rent, specifically to be used as a church. Curtis Jenkins is pastor of the Church of His Enduring Grace. His family helps out. In October, his brother was scouting new locations on Craigslist and saw the club's building.
It was almost too good to be true. It was like, somebody's trying to run a scam or something like that.
But a few days later, Al Woods gave them a tour.
Remember the dungeon area?
Well, this is the beginning of a beginning.
That's Curtis's mom, Aura Lee Jenkins. He calls her the church's overseer. She's videotaping the whole thing. They signed a 3-year lease for $2,000 a month. When I visited on a Sunday morning in early December, they were getting the place ready to hold services, tweaking the sound system, putting up decorations. The walls were still painted a kind of mottled black, and praying. So the Church of His Enduring Grace settled in, and plans for the sex club to operate at this location as the fellowship center appear to be kaput. So why didn't Al Woods push for that fire inspection and keep trying to open his haven for swingers? He won't exactly say, and sometimes he makes it sound like the whole church idea had been a joke. I asked Larry Roberts.
I think Al was just out of money. I know that his water was disconnected at one time.
There wasn't any revenue coming in. Between buying the new place and all the repairs, he'd spent the $1 million he'd gotten from selling the old building. And even with no mortgage, the new building carried some big costs. Taxes and insurance run about $2,000 a month. Al used to have other businesses besides the club. Magazines for swingers, a strip club, a line of amateur porn videos back when VHS was a thing.
I've made money. I've lost money. Made a lot of money when the 900 numbers were popular. Made a bunch of bad investments with people.
And eventually illness forced him to retire.
Since I got cancer, I haven't been that active for the last 6 years, I guess, now.
He says he's comfortable living on his Social Security and his VA pension, but he can't carry the building, too. And pushing forward with the whole swingers church idea would have run into another problem. Even if they had fought the zoning battle and won, even if they had reopened, another important group would have been unhappy about the idea of the club calling itself a religious institution. Members. Al still throws parties a couple times a month at local hotels. I went to one. I met a couple who wouldn't give me their names. They told me they'd been married for 39 years. He said he can't have sex because of an injury, and the club had been an accommodation. They also told me that the idea of the club calling itself a church had completely rubbed them the wrong way.
How comfortable with that terminology?
Because church is important to you.
Yes,
it is. God is important to me, yes. And but using a place to have sex as a church is wrong. So.
Yes, it is. Very wrong.
And you didn't think, if they'd gone through with that, you might have had to go someplace else.
Sure.
Sure, I wouldn't have gone in.
The party that night felt sad. There weren't a lot of people there, not a lot of mixing, very little dancing. One couple called it lame, not in a mean way, more like a lament. It was like crashing a poorly attended wake. The next day, I asked Al Woods how disappointed he is by the whole episode.
It's life. So can't do anything about it. You know, you just keep going, you know. And not for the religious reason, but things happen for a reason sometimes, you know, and makes you either stronger or doesn't.
Later, I called Al to ask him another question. What about the people like that couple I met at the party who thought it was just wrong to call a sex club a church? He said, I don't care if I call it a bar or a church or humane society or whatever. I need the income. For now, he's getting that income in the form of rent from the Church of His Enduring Grace.
That story was from reporter Dan Weissman. We want to remind you that you can listen to Reveal whenever you want. You can subscribe to our podcast at revealnews.org/podcast. We'll have more from the front lines of the religious freedom debate when we come back. This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey folks, it's Byer Duncan from Reveal.
A few weeks ago, during our episode with Michigan Radio exploring the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, we asked you to tweet us with tips on other communities that have faced their own water-related problems. And you sent us lots of great, important stories of how man-made water disasters are still affecting residents across the country. We selected a few of your submissions and contacted the reporters on the ground who are still following the issues. From a 2014 chemical spill in West Virginia that affected thousands of residents, to border towns in Texas struggling for clean water, we got an insider's look at what's being done right now about these water crises outside of Flint. You can read them on our website at revealnews.org/waterreads. Again, that's revealnews.org/waterreads.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. If you drive about 85 miles northeast of Columbia, Missouri, along a two-lane highway lined with corn and soybean fields, you'll crest a hill, and then you'll see it. Heartland, a privately owned Christian community in the middle of nowhere. But it has its own medical center, an airport, a dairy, and a zoo. And Heartland's most famous feature is a school. Parents from all over the country send their kids there for Christian, Bible-based education. They know that teachers there don't spare the rod. For some, that's a selling point. The other thing about the Heartland School, because it claims a religious exemption, the state can't inspect it. So who's keeping tabs on the school and making sure the kids are safe? Abigail Keel takes us there to find out.
Here's what Heartland's website says. If you desire a school for your children where God is honored, the Bible is revered as the standard for life, and excellence is pursued, consider Heartland Christian Academy. Sarah Barton's parents sent her there when she was 14 years old, and as she puts it, pretty out of control.
I mean, just the things that I put myself through, I'd run away so much, and it got to the point where my friends wouldn't even house me. I would sleep sometimes in the park, sometimes in the woods.
Sarah's parents sent her to Heartland for the structure, not the religion. But she ended up finding something she says she needed.
I didn't have a relationship with my mom until I came here, and now we have a great relationship. When you're so selfish and so into what you're doing, you don't really have time to have relationships with people. And if you do have relationships with people, you're just using them in that relationship.
And it was at Heartland that Sarah found Jesus.
Of course, Jesus is the forefront of everything. You know, besides a stable environment, I don't even know what Heartland would have to offer besides Jesus. I mean, he is the answer to all things. He saved me. He saved my family. He restored my family. He gave me opportunity.
Sarah isn't alone. We spoke with half a dozen former students at Heartland who said the school gave them the stability and structure to break bad habits. But along with its emphasis on the Bible, Heartland has a style of discipline and punishment that some people say crosses the line. Even in Missouri, one of 19 states that allow schools to spank or hit students.
Hi there.
Hello.
How are
Pleasure
you?
To meet you.
Charles Sharp, or Pastor Charlie, is the founder and current leader of Heartland.
We try everything. Spanking is the last resort. But when it comes down to that, if you can't get a kid to do what you tell them, what would you do?
Charles Sharp founded Ozark National Life Insurance in Kansas City, Missouri in 1964. He's 88 years old and still president of the company. In 1995, Sharp found what he says was his real calling. Everyone at Heartland knows the story. He was driving along a country road and says he heard the voice of God.
And the Lord said to me, "Now you can hear me. It's me. I'm talking to you. I want you to build a place for kids."
Pastor Charlie's mission at Heartland is to provide the kind of instruction that he believes will put youth on the right path, and to combat the problems he sees with how society deals with children.
Why do you think today our juvenile places are packed? The kids are wonderful. They just don't have anybody to raise them. They don't have anybody to teach them. But all of those problems would be solved if we just knew God.
Pastor Charlie says Heartland does undeniable good in changing people's lives. He defends the strict discipline at the school.
We have no abuse here. There is none. We have no zero tolerance.
But some former students disagree. Leah DeVoe Scribner was a student from 2003 to 2005. She lives in Alaska now and spoke with us on Skype about the practice called swatting.
I shaved my armpits once. That was the first time I got swats.
Swats are a regular form of discipline at Heartland. You bend over and hold the edge of a chair, and a staff member swats you with a wooden paddle.
I know people wouldn't say corporal, most people wouldn't say corporal punishment or swatting is abuse, but when you're getting, I mean, we would get swats from, you know, men in their 30s, and it's hard to talk about just because they would do it for, you know, nothing at all. And I know people, girls, that they would get the 10 swats for a week straight just for one thing that they did wrong.
One incident, Leah says, went too far.
The guy hit me so hard that I fell forward and moved my shoulder weird, and it dislocated, popped right out of place. And for the next few days, I can't remember how many exactly, my whole arm, it was just so much pain, and it was swollen and just like, I mean, it was turning blue.
Leah says she saw a doctor after this incident, which her sister confirmed. Punishments at the school aren't just physical. Maya Swanson's parents sent her to Heartland in 2001 when she was 9 years old. She lived there for 7 years.
If they did something really bad, they would obviously put the girls in an orange suit or an ugly dress with a sign that said "talk out," and that's part of the that's a way to really humiliate somebody.
The orange suits are prison-style jumpsuits that students must wear when they've broken a rule. The staff says it helps them spot children trying to run away after getting in trouble. And when a student wears the talk out sign, they aren't allowed to speak unless directed to by staff. Heartland Christian Academy operated from 1995 until 2001 without oversight or interference from local authorities. As a religious school, Heartland is exempt from licensing and inspection. Plus, they had the support of the families whose children they were disciplining. But in 2001, the separation between church and state started to crack. That's because of what came to be called the manure pit incident. Several students at Heartland were directed to stand in cow manure as punishment for misbehaving. Someone called a child abuse hotline, and the state brought criminal charges against 5 Heartland staff members. 3 of them were acquitted, and charges were dropped against the other 2. A jury said the incident was just farm labor at a rural school. 6 months later, a staff member punctured a student's eardrum during an altercation. Soon after, authorities got a warrant to raid Heartland Christian Academy. Maya Swanson was one of the children taken in the raid and later returned to the school by her family.
October 30th is when the juvenile officers, I don't know how many, but there was just way too many that came unexpectedly and went in and took 115 students out. For me, it was very, I mean, I was 9 years old. It was very chaotic.
I said, we're going to get away from this camera. We're going to do something.
Heartland staff were videotaping during the raid. You can see state officers escorting children out of the school, loading them onto school buses. Students are yelling and resisting, and staff members are arguing with the officers evacuating the school. Heartland and a group of parents sued state authorities, saying that removing the students was rash and harmful. Judge E. Richard Weber presided over the federal lawsuit. The videotape was used as evidence in the trial, and it made a big impression on the judge.
It was atrocious. I mean, they went in and rounded the kids up. There was this one young girl who braced herself at the door of the bus and refused to get in, and this 250-pound officer got behind her and just pushed her, and she was screaming, and everybody in the bus was screaming. I mean, it was chaotic. It was so unlike any kind of a practice anyone would have that believed in the Constitution or believed in fairness.
Could you kind of just walk me through exactly what you ruled and, you know, the reasoning behind it?
I found a violation of the Fourth Amendment, that there was an illegal seizure. I found that the juvenile officers of the Second Circuit and the 41st Circuit had conspired to violate the constitutional rights of the children.
Judge Weber said that the system isn't flawed. accusations like the eardrum incident were investigated, and evidence of abuse just didn't surface. Other parents filed lawsuits too, and the state had to pay Heartland's $800,000 legal fees. When I asked the judge if there was anything else I should know about the case, he said this.
I think the lesson, one of the many lessons I learned in the case, was that Mr. Sharp and his wife created that organization for laudable reasons. They've had amazing success in improving the lives of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That all of the horrors for which they were suspected of causing didn't occur. This is a fellow who did well in private business and went out and had a dream and part of the American dream to start a business or an organization that helps people.
Heartland is an example of how the tensions between public and private interests are wrapped up with religion. The state can't interfere because it's a Christian school. Simply put, it's their religious freedom. Matt Frank is a deputy metro editor for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He reported on Heartland shortly after the raid.
In Missouri, it's always been the case that parents and faith-based groups are considered far more expert on the welfare of youth and children than the government is. And I think that's a greater reason why we don't see more regulation of those entities.
Missouri requires most child care facilities and residential care facilities to be at minimum inspected for health and safety. Religious institutions like Heartland can claim an exemption from being inspected. And in Missouri, all they even have to do is claim it.
If you believe that you have this faith exemption as a facility, that's good enough. You don't have to apply to verify that that's the case.
Heartland lies at the intersection of three counties. Jules DeCoster is the prosecutor for one of those, Lewis County, where the manure pit incident took place.
Even freedom of religion doesn't give you the ability to violate the law without repercussions. So, you know, when you're talking about educating children or disciplining children, it seems to me like somebody needs to have some form of supervision.
But it's not that simple, because regulating Heartland also means regulating what choices parents are allowed to make about their own children.
It's a fundamental values conflict for us.
Candy Iveson is a social work professor at the University of Missouri. She says changing laws that deal with child welfare and exemptions is challenging.
This is the state intruding in the unit, the family, right, that we consider most sacrosanct. So it is a policy area that is very, very nuanced and difficult.
In Missouri, there's a lot of political support for parental rights and religious freedom. According to the Missouri Ethics Commission, Charles Sharp, his wife Lori, their business associates, and their corporations have donated just under $1 million to political candidates and organizations since 2002. Sharp's company has two lobbyists. One is the former chairman of the Missouri Republican Party. The last time Missouri's lawmakers took on child welfare law in 2004, Sharp's interests were represented. Matt Frank says the 2001 raid at Heartland and its expensive legal aftermath makes changing child welfare laws difficult today. The state's failure makes Missouri's lawmakers less likely to want to get involved with private religious facilities.
I think the raid and the aftermath of the raid continue to exert their influence over the legislative process. Culturally and in the legislature, it's just not part of their thinking to want to regulate in this area.
There haven't been any arrests or prosecutions at Heartland over discipline since the raid. The school still gives children swats. Leah DeVoe Scribner, the student who told us about her shoulder being dislocated, says her mother removed her from Heartland soon after, in 2005. We asked Leah what she would say now to the school's founder, Charles Sharp, about the discipline at Heartland.
I would just say that he doesn't know the damage that he's done.
Even Pastor Charlie recognizes his program isn't ideal for everyone.
I'm sure there's kids that don't think they had a great experience because they didn't want to change. And it is a terrible place for a person that doesn't want to change. This is right close to hell, about as close as you can get, because we want them to know what hell's going to be like when they get there. If you don't want to change, you don't want to come here.
Heartland has continued to thrive in the past decade, and enrollment at the school has grown. Just before we went to air, we called the school and asked about the current policies on physical punishment. They declined to comment. But former students we spoke with said the rules state that students shouldn't be swatted by staff members of the opposite gender, and no punishments should include more than 10 swats per day.
Our story on Heartland was produced by Abigail Keel. Special thanks to Ryan Femuliner at KBIA, where a version of this story originally aired, and to Earwolf Studios in New York. Finally, this hour, one last story about religious freedom as the issue lands on a rabbi's doorstep.
This gentleman came to the door and he said, "We've been given, you know, information that you will be having meetings in your house."
That's Rabbi Yosef Konnikoff. In 2000, he and his family had just moved into their home in an Orlando suburb. His family practices a type of Judaism called Chabad. It's a very social form of Judaism, and so often they have guests at their house. The county said that violated zoning rules against using your home as a place of worship, so they would send code enforcement officers to see what was going on.
The first official notice we got was on a Jewish holiday called Purim. And my wife called me and she said, "You got to come home right away. This officer is here and he's like threatening. He's really tough." And he gave us a citation. And I rushed home and then I saw the notice. And the notice said, "We're in violation for operating a synagogue or services affiliated with a synagogue and or church synagogue." The county really didn't want to let go. Well, it started first with undercover surveillance. So they would have people like hiding in the trees, literally, taking pictures.
Rabbi Konnikoff says the county documented everything. Eventually, they took the Konnikoffs to court, and the legal battle dragged on for years. All the while, the Konnikoffs are racking up fines and fees.
They considered our house to be in violation, which means there's a fine every day. It doesn't matter if I was on vacation, so we just automatically get a fine every day. Ultimately, it was somewhere around $80,000.
The Konnikoffs finally won their battle in the courts. In this case, their right to have people come into their house for worship trumped the neighborhood zoning laws. But the line between religious freedoms and secular laws is a difficult one and is being redrawn every day. For more on what you just heard, plus our latest stories, go to revealnews.org and join our conversations on Facebook or Twitter. Delaney Hall was our lead producer for this episode, and this was one of the last shows she worked on before leaving us. We miss you, Delaney, and really specifically, I miss you. You're one of the best producers I've ever worked with. We wish you all the best at your new post at 99% Invisible. Today's show was edited by Deb George. Our theme music today was from Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.